Welcome back to Decouple. Today I'm joined by returning guest, although it has been a very long time, Dr. Siver Wang. Siver, you are a oceanographer. You're also, I'm going to get you to kind of do your own little introduction here, but you work at the Breakthrough Institute, and I'll let you give your title. We are going to be chatting about deep sea mining, and this is an issue that I have been fascinated by for over a year. And I've been trying to find the right person to talk to. And for whatever reason, that's been really difficult. I've, been bugging my friends over at the Australian, there's the Mineral Council of Australia, and they weren't able to come up with any real good names for me. I saw you put an article out recently on this very topic. And then I remembered that, yeah, you are a ocean scientist. I'm blundering through your introduction. So yeah, just take 60 seconds. Tell us who you are and why you love the ocean and you know, why you stumbled across this topic.
Yes, thanks so much for having me again, Chris. It's good to be back. I'm Siver Wang. I am co-director of the Climate and Energy Program at the Breakthrough Institute. So as Chris mentioned, my background is originally in oceanography. I was an ocean biogeochemist and an ocean microbial ecologist. I studied the interaction between surface ocean plankton and the carbon and nitrogen cycles. As Chris mentioned, you know, I came to this topic from a very interesting angle. I came to it originally. I was actually an opponent of deep sea mining, even as recently as 3 or 4 years ago. But as I learned more, particularly about how we actually source metals and materials on land, I came to look at the topic from a different angle. So my current work at the Breakthrough Institute is on supply chains for clean energy technologies. We do a lot of our work on mining, on ore processing, on metal smelting, and on manufacturing. Basically, how do we get all of the electric vehicle batteries or wind turbines or copper for transformers that we think we're going to need for the energy transition. And so particularly in the process of doing that work, I've come to understand sort of the environmental footprint of extraction sort of as it is currently, the status quo, the sort of the conventional approaches for mining. And after learning more about deep sea mining and weighing the impacts, I've come to sort of change my mind on the topic, actually.
Well, strong opinions loosely held. And was it John Maynard Keynes? When the facts change, I change my mind. What do you do, sir? I always love, this isn't like a conversion story, Saul on the road to Damascus or anything, but I do love that. I love when people can be flexible in their thinking. Siver, I think very similar things are drawing me towards this technology, but I'm far less informed than you are. So maybe first off, though, let's frame it. I mean, terrestrial mining's pretty intense stuff. We're using a lot of explosives to blow up a lot of rock, and we're blowing up more and more of that rock because the ore grades are dropping, and we need to therefore process more of that base rock, remove more overburden, crush it up. It's interesting. I was talking to Ed Conway recently, his great book, The Material World, where he really, goes behind. I always kind of use this metaphor of the grocery store. He goes behind the shop aisle to see how the sausage gets made, and he follows, sand, steel, lithium, a number of different sort of material inputs through their supply chains. And it's absolutely fascinating. Check out the interview we just did a few weeks ago with him. he goes through how copper ore grades, for instance, in like the Bronze Age, you could find deposits that were like 20% copper. And they've dropped to sort of 6% in 1900, and I think 1% in the year 2000, and 0.6% now. And there may be enough minerals available. I'm not sure how that's, in terms of reserves and resources, but we got to use a lot more energy to crush them up even finer and extract these declining ore grades. So the idea that there's these, nice little nodules of fairly high purity ore down there seems exciting. But yeah, sorry, I went on a diatribe. Tell me a little bit more, though, about your thoughts, and how kind of, I don't want to say dirty and nasty terrestrial mining is, but yeah, those are value-laden words, but lead me through your little journey of conversion and what you've looked at in terms of terrestrial mining that makes the deep sea stuff look not so bad, and then we'll talk about what exactly deep sea is.
Yes. So that's a very important follow-up question: what deep sea mining actually is, because I think that's often where a lot of people sort of jump to assumptions about what they think it is. and maybe are often surprised to sort of learn what it actually would entail. But conventional mining is typically the way you get metals in our as it is you if the deposits are close to the surface, you do a surface mine sometimes called an open pit mine. You remove a lot of overburden to get to the ore body, and then you remove remove successive layers of the target deposit. Or if the deposit is much deeper, you do underground mining. You drop mine shafts, and then you actually tunnel into those rock layers deep underground, sometimes several kilometers even underground. And so I want to avoid casting terrestrial mining too much as, you know, abhorrent or horrible, because the fact of the matter is that it is actually the foundation of industrial civilization. You go around walking in a modern city, and you know you've got copper cables in all the circuit boxes next to you. You've got steel in railings, in rebar, in reinforcing steel columns all around you. So the entirety of sort of modern civilization depends upon metals. If we didn't mine metals, we would still be hunter gatherers. So recognizing that, we should always be pushing ourselves to mine better, and we have been. Terrestrial mining has even improved significantly in the last 20 to 40 years even. Particularly when you look at metrics that people sometimes don't think about, for example, such as worker safety. That said, at the end of the day, terrestrial mining, you're moving large quantities of earth, on the order of tens to hundreds to thousands of kilograms of earth for every kilogram of metal that you're actually turning into a finished product at the end. And you're disturbing large quantities of Earth's surface, less so for an underground mine, but a significant amount for a surface mine, and that is essentially clear cutting the surface vegetation. And then because you're doing all of this digging, you have to drain an underground mine to make sure it doesn't flood, and then you've got these piles of tailings, which is the rock that's within the ore body that isn't actually the valuable product, as well as sort of other waste rock like the overburden that you removed that's sitting in piles. And because it's been dug up into fine material and deposited as large piles, that creates risks for water pollution, because when it rains on those piles, it's more easy, because now the surface areas of those materials is larger, for potentially unpleasant stuff to leach around. And there are controls for all of this. We line our tailings piles now. You sort of have to submit mine plans that take into account the local hydrology to make sure that stuff doesn't get into the water table. But all the same, these risks are some of these differences are just sort of inherent, because at the end of the day, you are digging to get these materials. And then also there's a vast disparity globally in how mining is done, which may mean that standards vary significantly from country to country, which may increase or decrease the relative environmental risk.
Right, right. And I mean, fundamentally, we are terrestrial creatures, and sometimes these compete for space. I'm thinking of, not to choose too politicized of an example, but the German open pit lignite mines, which are consuming villages and communities that are being evacuated, and historic churches that are being felled. But I've traveled a fair amount in Central America and South America, and sometimes those conflicts are very real, and local farming communities are very impacted. So with that in mind, let's talk a little bit about deep sea mining. Why don't you start off with the actual geology of these deposits? Or even just like, let's get super meta and just talk about how, ores tend to concentrate themselves, because it's funny, like they are renewable resources. Like, where do these minerals come from? How do they deposit themselves? But the time frame of their renewal is, hundreds of millions of years, I think, in many cases. So if you want to go meta there and just in general, how mineral deposits kind of concentrate, zooming in on what the hell's going on the deep sea seafloor, I think that's kind of the area of fascination.
Sure, sure. And I'll start by scoping this conversation a bit, because there are actually several types of seafloor mining, and we're really only going to be talking about one type here, which is polymetallic nodules. So there are other kinds of seafloor mining that have been proposed that in some cases, they actually look like conventional mining, but you're just doing it on the seafloor, you know, digging ocean crusts or lopping off ocean hydrothermal vents to mine. And that's not what we're talking about. That would be higher impact kind of work. So what we are talking about are polymetallic nodules. And polymetallic nodules are roughly potato-sized accretions of mostly manganese, of heavily manganese. They're around 30% manganese by mass. And then and then there are smaller quantities of nickel, copper, and cobalt in that order that have accumulated in these nodules. And these nodules have accumulated through sort of natural ocean mineralogical and chemical processes. Like Chris said, they've accumulated over tens to hundreds of millions of years into these sort of potato-sized rocks. And it's a natural process. You would expect them to regrow. But again, on vast geological timescales, I think it is probably fairer to say that they are non-renewable, yeah. Particularly on our very measly short human timescales. But there's great differences in you know, these polymetallic nodules, which are literally just sitting on the seafloor, sort of, you know, half buried or even just sitting entirely on top of the seafloor, versus ocean crusts or hydrothermal vent minerals that are locked in sort of fixed deposits. The difference being that you can actually go and pick up these nodules. And so what we're talking about when it comes to so-called deep sea mining, or DSM, which is really just nodule collection, is sending robotic, remotely operated vehicles down to the seafloor. And then these vehicles will use one of several techniques. Most commonly, they're using water jets to actually suspend these nodules, sort of mobilize the sediment underneath them and sort of get them to float, and then suck these nodules into the vehicle and then transport them via a hydraulic pump, up to a collector vessel on the seafloor. So you think you've got a collector vessel on the sea surface. You've got a long pipe leading down to a robotically controlled vehicle, and that's it. That's the system. So you compare that to a land-based mine or some of the alternative seafloor mining techniques which have been discussed, which so far I oppose the other techniques. You know, ocean crustal mining or hydrothermal vent mining, but the footprint is much smaller. It's almost basically like driving a little car over the surface of the ocean and picking up what's in the car's path, pretty much.
Right. Well, let's talk kind of a little more philosophically about humanity's relationship to the ocean, particularly modern humanity, and I guess more of the kind of romantic modern humanity's conceptions and thoughts about the ocean. Like, I think the frames of reference I have for this, like, what other resources do we pull from the ocean? Well, we pull fish out of the ocean, and we use these, you know, factory trawler ships, and probably, you know, over-subsidize and over-harvest and screw up that renewable resource. The ocean's been used, I guess, as like a dumping ground in the past. So let's talk a little bit about, yeah, how, I guess, particularly like industrial Homo sapiens have interacted with the ocean, and how we sort of have started to philosophically think about it, and how that's become conceptualized into certain laws and treaties. Because I understand that right now, this deep sea mining ain't even legal.
Right. So the list is long and quite exhaustive of the ways in which humanity interacts with the ocean currently. So there's, of course, the indirect impacts like climate change, which results in ocean acidification, other changes in ocean chemistry and ocean physics. There is a nutrient pollution. So because we use, you know, large amounts of fertilizer on land, and because of other sort of nutrient inputs like sewage, for example, we're introducing a lot of nutrients via rivers into coastal oceans, which has dramatically changed the biogeochemistry of sort of coastal waters. And then, you know, there are more sort of direct economic activities like fishing being one of the largest ones. A major one that people don't often think about is just ocean shipping. You know, a large amount of large ocean vessels transit the ocean each day, transporting, you know, upwards of 95% of of human trade and commerce. And you know, those vessels have impacts like noise, particulate pollution, et cetera, that have affected the ocean now for well over, 150 years at this point. And because of that commerce, actually, and this goes back even further to the days of sail, there have actually been impacts as well from introduction of invasive species. Stuff hitches a ride on boats and then gets brought to new areas where sometimes it turns out to be very, very well suited to those areas and sort of outcompetes the existing organisms there. And, invasion is in many ways a natural process too, because stuff can raft over on logs as well. But humans have sort of accelerated this process inadvertently, even if it happened previously. And then, we actually do modify the seafloor already. We do oil and gas extraction. We lay large amounts of subsurface cables, not just for electricity, but also for telecommunications. And it's worth noting, too, that, the seabed is vast. And so, the impacts of any of those activities, be it oil and gas extraction or laying transatlantic cables or deep sea mining, we're really talking about very, very small, minuscule, really, percentages of the seafloor, because the seafloor is vast. It's 2/3 of the ocean surface compared to the 1/3 of sort of land surface area that we have. But that's a quick snapshot, and not even exhaustive. There's stuff dynamite mining, coral harvesting, etc. But the humans, basically the point is humans interact a lot with the ocean already, and we have to recognize that.
Yeah, so that was kind of impacts. And then in terms of resources that we take out, I mean, obviously whales was an early one, fishing, and we've overfished. And when people, I think, talk about, it sounds like this is small localized activities, they think about the enormous impacts humanity has had in aggregate on fish stocks, et cetera. I mean, I guess we also mine a lot of sand from the ocean. Little like islands and reefs and stuff. But I mean, sand, especially construction-worthy sand, seems to be something of a tight commodity in some places. So I'm curious, like, so you said it's a small subsection of the ocean surface. Why is it deep? Like, do these things not form in shallower continental shelves? Why do you get these little potato nodules? They sound pretty cool and crazy to me. Why do they form where they do, and what is this widespread across the deep oceans? Because as you said, that's a big space.
Yeah, so admittedly my inorganic chemistry is pretty poor. That was my worst ever grade in throughout my undergraduate and graduate studies. So I don't actually know the precise answer to that. But I do know that these deposits are only found at great depths. So we're talking 3 to 5-ish kilometers.
And in terms of, like, that sounds technically challenging. So how far along is this technology? I've heard of like calls to just ban it outright. It reminds me a little bit of geoengineering, where there's this tension between like, hey, maybe we're going to need this stuff, we should probably do the science. And then other people saying, if we do the science, we're more likely to do it. It's going to have unanticipated consequences. So, this is like a new frontier. So how is that sort of proceeding?
Yeah, so it's new, but like many ideas in mining, it's also old, actually. So many innovative new mining techniques, extracting metals using, solution, so-called solution mining, using sort of liquids, pumping liquids into rock layers to get metals, deep sea mining. These ideas actually often date back to the 60s and 70s. We were aware of the existence of manganese modules, in the mid 20th century, and it's been so these materials have been coveted for a long time, but as might be expected, it's only very recently, sort of with advances in, particularly with advances in sort of remotely operated vehicles, that have made it more feasible economically to actually think about collecting these rocks at commercially speaking and at sort of economic costs. So the true sort of industrial interest is really only more recent, within the last 20 years or so, I'd say.
So you described briefly, this kind of robot that goes around vacuum cleaning these things up, shunting them to the surface where there's this vessel. I'm just wondering if you can go into that in a little more detail so people can understand also what people are saying the impacts would be. What are the environmental harms of stirring up this deep sea floor? How kind of ecologically diverse or valuable is it? I mean, again, this is turning into sort of human value propositions, but people tend to like weird and exotic environments and biodiversity and things like that. So is this just like a dead, you know, barren space far from any light and energy flows, or is there a lot going on down in nodule land?
Sure. Yeah, there are lots of questions there. I'll start with the second half.
Sure.
You talk about people really valuing sort of, you know, exotic, sort of extreme environments. And I might actually challenge that proposition a bit, because having worked on even surface ocean plankton for 5 years, my takeaway really from all of that work was that very few lay people actually care. About plankton, and surface ocean plankton are actually important, but deep ocean organisms are you know, realistically speaking, infinitely less important than surface ocean microbes. I mean, surface ocean microbes are actually very important, but this is a very barren landscape. We're talking about the abyssal seafloor, where, you know, there isn't a single scrap of light down there. Much of the ocean, basically, aside from a few autotrophs, a few sort of organisms that can make their own energy the entirety of that ecosystem subsists essentially off of the detritus that falls down from the surface ocean. And it's very, very little biomass down there, living biomass down there in the deep ocean. On the abyssal seafloor, we're talking like 10 grams of living biomass per square meter, compared to, say, 20 to 40 kilograms of living life in like a temperate to tropical forest on land. So orders of magnitude, many orders of magnitude difference in the richness of biomass. Now, that being said, we have to be sort of clear-eyed about what the impacts of deep sea mining would actually be. So certainly anything in the path of the collector vehicle, the collector vehicle is expected to disturb like approximately the upper 6 to 8 centimeters of sediment, and, you know, it's going to subject anything caught on the surface or buried to that depth to, you know, large differences in pressure. It's going to sort of rip them out of their environment, and so, you know, the real operating assumption is that those vehicles are going to kill anything that's caught up within the path of the harvester. Now, that isn't any different from, you know, bulldozers that are bulldozing, you know, Indonesian rainforest for a nickel mine, for a conventional nickel mine today. But it is an impact, and we have to be clear-eyed about that. The other impacts, the collector vehicle is also sucking up a lot of sediment with the nodules as it's doing this. And the sediment is going to be ejected from the back of the vehicle just at the ocean surface. And there are concerns that this creates a plume of sort of fine suspended sediments, and that plume could travel a great distance horizontally or vertically and sort of rain down as snow on the seafloor. There are organisms down on the seafloor that, for example, use filters to feed, like sea lilies. They're trying to catch particles. And the concern is that they might be catching a lot of the sediment as well, and that might negatively impact them. Or if the sediment plume is even thick enough, it could bury seafloor life. And then the final impacts that people are concerned about are noise, as the nodules are sort of rattling up and getting pumped up to the surface vessel. And also there are minor impacts like light, for example, from the collector vehicles in this area that's, you know, pitch dark.
And just to clarify, that plume is happening out the back end of the vehicle, or it's up at the surface near the surface collector ship?
So that's an incisive question. So there is a plume out the back of the vehicle. But then, of course, as the nodules are pumped up to the surface vessel, there is some sediment that's transported up as well. So currently, the direction in which draft regulations seem to be leaning is that they will require these operators to return that water, that excess water, and remaining sediment back down to near the ocean seafloor, if not at the ocean seafloor. So it'll be returned at a depth of like 3 or 4 kilometers down as well. And that plume of return water and fine sediment is going to be a lot more dilute in terms of sediment than the plume coming out the collector vessel.
So you hear, or I've heard anyway, that there's sort of deserts in the ocean where there's just no fertilizer. They're not, you know, there's an excess of fertile ingredients coming mostly from, I guess, our ammonia production and down our riverbeds. And I think it's called like alluvial dust off of glaciers and things like that. Would a little bit of sediment be good in these areas to like, you know, might blanket some deep ocean life, but it might also fertilize some of the more active upper parts of the ocean, which could benefit. Is there a cost benefit analysis here of that?
So I don't think so, because so first off, now that it seems like the mine operators will be required to return this water at great depth, the surface ocean community would largely, one would think, be unaffected by these activities. And then at depth, this is an environment where nutrients are not the limiting factor. In fact, the deep ocean is already very nutrient rich. So think of the deep ocean as where all the decomposition happens. You know, stuff dies or fish poop, and it sinks all the way down to the deep ocean, where that stuff then gets decomposed by microbial life, by microorganisms, and by sort of scavengers. And so it gets broken down into its, you know, constituent carbon, which the deep ocean is very rich in carbon, as well as nutrients. So the deep ocean is already nutrient rich. And so reintroducing those sediment fines into the deep ocean would not change that. It's other factors like light, for instance, the very, very cold temperatures of the deep ocean, which restrict metabolism, and even the rich and even sort of because organisms have to be so well adapted to those pressures, to that sort of harsh environment, the evolutionary trade-offs they had to make to survive in that environment means they're not going to just sort of like multiply like a harmful algal bloom would on the surface.
Right. Okay. So I'm going to have to take a slight tangential turn here, because I was listening to my friend Nate Hagen's podcast, and he had Sir Somebody. He's a big climate scientist in the UK who advised, I think, the Blair government and a few others. And he's passionate about this project, and this has nothing to do with deep sea mining. So forgive this, Seaver and the audience, but it was a cool idea. Basically, he talks about how like whale poo is, a massive sort of source of fertilizer throughout the ocean. And he had this plan as, I think, a way to sort of sink carbon, because when whales, take a dump on the ocean, it's a huge source of sort of fertility, obviously drops to the bottom as well. But it's sort of trying to emulate that with taking, I think, again, like alluvial particle and sediment from Greenland, putting it on rice husks so it would float and sort of have some presence in the upper ocean and serve as like a source of, I guess, like a plankton bloom that then would settle down and sink some carbon. This is a total aside. I'm not sure if you know anything about it, but I guess the reason I'm asking it is because it sounds like, well, if you take this nutrient-rich material up from the floor, like why not put it up in the surface where, you know, I guess there's just very little energy flow outside of these thermal vents at the bottom of the ocean. You got energy and not as much nutrient on the top. Am I just being totally naive again in terms of a cost-benefit analysis? And like, why not put some nutrients up on the ocean surface, and maybe that'd be good for climate or for fish stocks or something else?
So you'd really have to sort of do the science and figure out whether this makes sense, because particularly if you're bringing deep water nutrients to the surface, you're really going to have to be careful about also bringing up deep ocean carbon, and sort of counteracting the fertilizing effect that you're trying to talk about here, because the deep ocean really is very rich in carbon dioxide, and so if you're ventilating a large amount of deep ocean CO2 to the surface, you might really be better off just, you know, planting trees instead, or doing some other sort of carbon removal method. But this general idea of ocean fertilization, you know, if, for example, if you're taking, you know, alluvial iron or artificial iron and nutrients and introducing into the ocean, that wouldn't have the same sort of deep ocean carbon concern that you're talking about. And this has been thought about for a long time. There's famously an oceanographer called Paul Martin who once said, give me half a tanker of iron and I'll show you an ice age. Because the idea was that you could with just a little bit of fertilization, catalyze so much carbon removal that you could actually sort of, reverse the accumulating greenhouse effect completely and sort of drop global temperatures. Now, subsequent science has suggested that the ocean biogeochemistry is a lot more difficult than that. You don't get as much bang for your buck as you think when you do the back of the envelope. because, you know, ocean ecosystems are complicated. You a lot of that biomass doesn't sink to the deep ocean. It gets eaten at the surface, and, you know, viruses and everything sort of surge to sort of cull the new accumulated biomass. So ocean fertilization, the effect is often a lot weaker than sort of people hope for. It's a huge topic, and honestly, perhaps worth a podcast episode of its own.
100%.
And I could recommend people if you want to talk about this. But people have thought about this for a long time, and many people have come away disappointed once they've actually sort of done the experiments.
Okay, right on. Thank you for the sojourn there, and I will follow up on your recommendations. Okay, so I mean, we're talking manganese, cobalt, nickel. I'm just kind of, again, trying to draw some comparisons, and I'm probably sounding like I'm this like massive advocate for deep sea mining. I think it's fascinating. It's curious. Ultimately, to me, it seems lower impact than like children in the Congo working in like slave conditions and very unsafe practices to, and it seems like most of the world's cobalt is currently sourced from Congo. So in terms of the specific minerals we're talking about, can you talk about their relevance and also where they're currently sourced and I guess the kind of relative environmental impacts of sourcing them from the deep sea versus the terrestrial environments they're currently mined from?
Sure. Yes. So we're talking, manganese, nickel, copper, and cobalt. So these minerals, to people who are involved in the energy transition, the first thing they think about is batteries. So specifically the sort of top of the line, most energy dense nickel, manganese, cobalt, or NMC batteries that are used in sort of long range electric vehicles, and that would probably have to be used for similar sort of energy, high energy density requirements like long range trucking or electric ocean cargo ships or electric aviation would probably have to use the most energy dense batteries available. So these sort of NMC batteries currently. Now there are alternative batteries like lithium iron phosphate batteries that do not use nickel, manganese, and cobalt. But those batteries are less energy dense. They are very suitable. They're increasing in popularity, particularly in sort of dense urban South Asia and East Asia, where you don't drive as long distances. You could sort of do with smaller cars, et cetera. And LFP, the future of LFP is going to be bright, but a lot of the sort of industry analysts that Bloomberg New Energy Finance or Fraunhofer are really thinking that NMC still will remain the sort of the plurality of electric vehicle battery chemistries going forward until at least, 2030, the mid-2030s. Now, I want to also call out that these minerals are not just used in electric vehicles. So many people are not aware of this, especially in the deep sea mining debate. But nickel and manganese are used in many ubiquitous steel and aluminum alloys. And steel and aluminum are very much going to also be metals of decarbonization. These are going to be used in vast quantities, whether it's to build, hydrogen pipelines or nuclear power plants or transmission infrastructure, for which you're also going to need a lot of copper for those substations. People talk about deep sea metals too often as if it's just batteries, but it really poses sort of pan energy transition implications. As for where they're sourced, currently most nickel is mined in Indonesia, most cobalt is mined in the Congo, with an increasing share of cobalt actually sourced as a byproduct of nickel mining in Indonesia. Most manganese is sourced from South Africa. And then copper is a long-time commodity that humans have mined at large scales. And so the copper supply chain is more sort of broadly distributed around the world.
What does these deep sea resources, I'm just trying to think of the scale, both of like how does the scale in terms of actually being a sizable percentage of demand and potentially take pressure off of terrestrial deposits, but also the scale of the kind of reserves and resources out there. Does this like markedly change the amount of copper we have available in the world for whatever the applications are we choose to use it for?
So it's funny you started with copper, because copper is actually one example of where currently we think there's way more resources actually in land-based resources than in the richest sort of nodule area that everyone's excited about, the Clarion Clipper 10. So copper is actually one where land-based resources are still perhaps the majority, although we know so little about the seafloor that understanding may well be wrong. For manganese in particular, we know that there's way more on the seafloor. Cobalt, that is very likely to be the case as well. There's likely to be more cobalt in these deep sea nodules than there is on land. And then finally, for nickel, it's about the same. So the currently known nodule resources versus currently known terrestrial nickel resources is about the same order of magnitude. Not just the same order of magnitude, about the same scale. Yeah, sorry.
In terms of the overall efficiency of like ore extraction, how does it compare? I mean, these sound like little kind of underwater drones and collection ships. What are people's projections of how much this could be scaled? What percentage of, you know, cobalt you could shift away from children mining in Congo towards this very flashy, high-tech way of extracting?
Yeah. I do want to just jump in and say that, you know, a lot of people, and I'm glad that a lot of people are concerned about, you know, abusive child labor in the Congo for cobalt. But I do want to call out that, you know, the Congolese government and international and sort of with international partners are doing a lot to try and make cobalt mining in the Congo better. So I do just want to call that out for a moment and recognize that, you know, it's not just an unsolvably bad situation. There are a lot of people working very hard to sort of make that mineral ecosystem economy better. But certainly deep sea mining is projected to be a bit of a game changer, potentially. The one thing that's very one thing that's very important to note is that all the operators who are proposing to collect nodules are suggesting that they would be a much lower cost than a lot of existing production. Because it's such a more streamlined operation, robots to pipes to ships, and the ships just go straight to a processing facility on shore. It's a way more streamlined operation than a terrestrial mine, where you have to do the mine plan, and then you may have to build the mine for 2 or 3 years. The mine development phase maybe 2 or 3 years before you're even producing metal. And then, you know, you've got these successive stages of getting to each rock layer, et cetera. It's much more involved. So deep sea mining could scale rather quickly, and it could also dramatically change these sort of commodity markets. It could change sort of the cost production curve of cobalt or nickel as we know it.
Maybe getting back to I don't know if you can. So you're saying these are scalable. This wouldn't be if this were kind of unleashed from a regulatory perspective. This could be like a significant contributor, as you're saying, not necessarily in copper, but in cobalt, manganese, and nickel. Just to confirm that this is, you know, because we hear about within the energy transition discourse, we constantly hear about these pilot projects, many of which don't have a hope in hell of scaling, but that consume a vast amount of oxygen in terms of the popular discourse and media. So I just want to get a sense: is this one of those things, or this has potential, scalability to it that will be impactful for extending reserves and, again, hopefully minimizing ecological impact to terrestrial ecosystems?
Yeah. So I'll put some numbers to this. So a lot of these operators are talking about scaling up within a few years, within just a couple of years, to collecting on the order of hundreds of thousands of tons of dry nodules, dry, you know, once they've been once the water weight has left them per year. And so, you know, if you think about these nodules being composed of like 30% manganese by mass. And then, around 1% of nickel and copper, and then around 0.2% cobalt. So you're talking, you know, tens of thousands of tons of manganese production per year. That's already the equivalent of one terrestrial mine. On the order of hundreds to thousands of tons of nickel and cobalt, which would already put them, you know, would already put them on the map in terms of production of these commodities. So, you know, it wouldn't start out as you know, it wouldn't be as if another Indonesia's worth of production springs into existence overnight. But they are scaling rapidly enough that it's the equivalent of putting new terrestrial mines into operation much faster than sort of the existing commodity economy would be able to do so.
And that's a major choke point, particularly in terms of permitting. We're saying this might be difficult in terms of existing ocean conventions, but sure as hell ain't easy to build a mine in the United States, for example, right now. And you know, in terms of working your way through the permissions and whatnot else. So is this happening? Is there like an environment in which this is being tested out? Are the regulations such that it, you know, I guess similar to a lot of geoengineering research, you just can't even do it. It's all theoretical and being done, you know, but with modeling and things like that. Or are people actually building these robotic vehicles and snipping off a few nodules and feeling it out?
No, existing international law does permit for small level tests. So there are actually not just private entities, but also government entities. Like, for example, NOAA has conducted deep sea mining testing in this Clarion-Clipperton zone of nodules between Hawaii and the United States. These are full scale in the sense that the vehicle and the rate of nodule collection, et cetera, are the same as what you'd expect in a commercial operation. It's just not like 12 vehicles down there harvesting at once. It's just one, and they're studying the impacts of that one vehicle. But you know, essentially they are doing, you know, full scale pilot testing already. So this means that there's actually already hard scientific data that we can talk about and that we are talking about in terms of informing regulations and debating what over how strict regulations can be. But commercial mining so far is not permitted. And the International Seabed Authority, which is the international governing body that has the responsibility for overseeing and regulating sort of seabed economic activities like nodule collection, is currently in the process of formulating a mining code. They are actually already overdue for when they were supposed to finalize a mining code. The expectation is that they're supposed to make significant progress on it by this summer. In terms of, you know, legality, there is actually a pathway towards legality where at some point the International Seabed Authority is supposed to say, okay, these are the standards you have to meet if you want to collect nodules.
So are these the kind of only minerals that we're looking at? These nodules sound like kind of a unique phenomenon. Is there the opportunity, or, you know, and I guess as you're saying, this really is kind of a final frontier. We've got some vessels that go down and kind of map out the seafloor from what I understand, but there's many, many places I'm guessing certainly no human has ever been close to, but maybe also any submersible has never been close to. Is there like a vast El Dorado? Are there other potential, you know, what are the known knowns? What are the unknown unknowns in terms of what other, you know, resources and minerals we could find down in the abyssal layers, if I'm using the right terminology?
So Norway, for example, recently made the news because they are within their own territorial waters, which don't fall under the boundaries of the governance of the International Seabed Authority. Norway recently has made moves towards exploratory seafloor nodule collection off of Svalbard, which is an island that belongs to Norway's Norwegian soil. In the far north of Norway, so there are other nodule areas on the seafloor around the world. Those nodules may differ to minor to moderate degrees in terms of their mineral composition. They might have, you know, slightly less manganese and slightly more nickel, vice versa. In general, the if we're talking nodules, we're talking these four metals. There have been discussions and sort of there has been some thinking about whether you could get other metals economically out of these nodules, like rare earth metals, for example. But now we're talking much, much, much smaller proportions of the nodule by weight, where that might not be economic, or it might be. We're not sure yet. So currently, a lot of people are not making any promises about what else you could get out of these nodules. So I think it's fair to say, for the most part, that this is mostly a conversation around nickel, copper, manganese, cobalt.
And just briefly, you mentioned two other forms of deep or of underwater mining, continental crust and thermal vent mining. And you said that these were a kind of no-no for you, ethically, morally, scientifically, I'm not sure what. Just briefly, if you can outline what those are, if they're different minerals that are involved, why they're being pursued, and why you don't think they're a good idea.
Sure, I'm less well versed on what's in those deposits, but my understanding is that it is different. There are different metals available, like for example, platinum group metals or rare earth metals. As for sort of why I'm more hesitant about those would involve sort of actual sort of so particularly for hydrothermal vents, those are actually more ecologically rich areas. Hydrothermal vents are areas of the seafloor where you'll see a lot more sort of biomass and biodiversity. There are these very unique sort of communities that have been built around sort of essentially
nuclear reactor.
You have plants that are living off of these hydrothermal geysers underwater that are rich in minerals, and you essentially have plants that have adapted to take those minerals and incorporate them and grow as biomass. So these areas are different than the abyssal seafloor, which arguably speaking is the most common surface area on Earth, and much less biomass rich.
Okay, I mean, I think we've really worked through a lot. It's great interviewing you because you kind of answer pretty promptly, and I feel like I ask questions with too many questions buried in them. So I'll give you an opportunity, just I guess in wrapping up, maybe just to talk about you said you've changed your mind on this. You're part of a broader discourse on this topic. First off, like, who's talking about it? Because if this is just the proponents talking about it, it's going to be kind of biased and balanced in that way. And what does that discourse look like? Are you hopeful that, it's going to, not necessarily the mining activity, but that the discourse is intelligent, that, because I think, again, this is sort of Jonathan Haidian of me, but I'm really sort of starting to really appreciate the breadth of political discourse, and that we have, libertarians and communists and everything in between. I think we're faced with a new problem, like a pandemic or whatever. It's good that we don't all see it through the same political lenses. So I'm glad that there's, people that, oppose everything. I mean, not that they oppose everything. I think you know what I'm trying to get at. It's good to have opponents. It's good to, red team ideas. So tell me a bit about the discourse about this and if you think it's a healthy one or not.
Sure. I do think there's a healthy scientific discourse going on. The academic literature is on the subject is very sort of vigorous. And I think that will do a great deal of good in terms of actually reforming informing the regulatory discussions that are going on at the International Seabed Authority. The public discourse I am quite dissatisfied with. I think actually it's often the case that people come away reading articles on a deep sea mining study or about deep sea mining, the topic in general, and come away without actually having learned that much about the subject. So I think the public discourse could really serve to benefit. As far as where I see the discourse going, whether I'm hopeful, I'm actually somewhat concerned that we're not talking about this technology with as much sort of critical thought as it deserves, with the ultimate risk that we may be shutting out a technology that could reduce the overall impacts with which we source metals for the energy transition, but we won't consider it because on the face of it it sounds horrendous, which I totally understand because that's where I was several years ago. And what really changed my mind was actually finding out how dissatisfactory this public discourse was. Once they actually compared the claims that many opponents were making about how this was going to decimate, tuna fisheries or send noise across the oceans for hundreds of kilometers or release toxic metals. And then I read these claims, and then I actually read the underlying studies, and I realized that these claims were being completely inflated, or in some cases even fabricated by opponents, in ways that directly diverge with the science, even as they were sort of screaming, listen to the scientists on deep sea mining. They were sort of making up their own findings to do so, and that was really a large part of the turning point for me, where I sort of realized that a lot of the opposition was not coming from having carefully reviewed the evidence, but was rather coming from more sort of fundamental sort of on principle opposition to this activity, no matter how it is done, and no matter to what scale.
Well, Steve, I think that was a good summary. And thank you for coming on. Again, it's been a bit of a quest to find someone to speak about it who's qualified, who's a good communicator. And I think you tick all those boxes. So thanks for coming on.
Thanks so much, Chris. It was my pleasure.